Yeah. I haven't turned around to find out, Your Honour. That's me, isn't it? My we're at the end of 22.
Yes.
22, and I think we're pretty much here on that.
Have we got the minimum, other minimum standards? 10 to 12.
So I was just going to touch on that briefly.
Thank you.
Covered that earlier, but the remaining clauses there were in Schedule C, relate to fertiliser application. So these are minimum farming standards for sacrifice paddocks and cultivation. And the issues with those remaining clauses include fertiliser application rates, whether the 5 metre setback for water bodies for cultivation should be more or less stringent, and whether commercial vegetable production should be excluded from that 5 metre setback. Turning now to farm environment plans, Schedules D1 and D2. SEPs are a key tool within Plan Change 1 for reducing the diffuse discharge of the four contaminants, and there is widespread support for the use of farm environment plans across witnesses and sectors. As explained above, there are two tiers of FEPs under PC1. There are low intensity and permitted activities. They require an uncertified standards-based FEP prepared in accordance with Schedule D1, while higher intensity consented activities, including commercial vegetable production, require a certified FEP, which is more discretionary and based on roles and principles rather than standards. And the latter FEPs are required to be prepared in accordance with Schedule D2.
Why do you put goals and principles in quotation marks?
That's a good question, Your Honour. I probably should have removed them in editing. But
well, I feel that there are occasions, particularly in complex situations, where principles may be more useful than standards. And yes. I think that this is a case where, and this has been raised previously, where it may well be that some qualitative approaches may have to be adopted, at least in the near future, while we're still trying to get a handle on what the quantitative limits may be.
Yes.
Is that right?
I think that's right, sir, and that's particularly why the process of having qualified and experienced people preparing and certifying these farm plans enables some trust to be placed in the judgment that those people bring to the issue to say, well, in this particular situation, here is the way to approach it. And so the council's endeavoured to build in enough of that flexibility to say, well, let's trust that process.
Okay. Well, it's right now.
And as explained previously, a particular issue that has arisen in relation to farm environment plans is that the freshwater farm plan regulations have effectively overtaken PC1. The pending regulations were addressed in Mr. Smith's evidence in chief, but the regulations were expected at that stage and not yet gazetted. As a result, there was some uncertainty about their final content, although inconsistencies with PC1 were anticipated. Mr. Smith's evidence in chief was based on his understanding of the likely content through publicly available information and his involvement in development of the new regulations. Mr. Smith confirmed the council was very keen to avoid a scenario where it's required to implement two separate farm plan regimes with significant misalignment between them results in duplication and legal uncertainty as to what is required. The regulations and the application order were approved by order in council on the 6th of June, and Mr. Smith and Mr. Trebilco subsequently filed supplementary evidence addressing those regulations. Mr. Smith's concerns about misalignment remain. As a result of those concerns, Mr. Trebilco proposed a suite of changes to PC1, and this is the key part, to require that farm environment plans are to firstly satisfy the requirements of Part 9 of the RMA, freshwater farmplan regulations and then satisfy the additional requirements for farm environment plans in PC1. And this approach relies on the RMA's provision that allows a specified instrument, and i.e. a rule and a plan, to restrict an activity more than a requirement of a freshwater farm plan. So that's what's been done here. So the freshwater farm plan is the base. These are additional tailored requirements for the local environment. Now, because the freshwater farm plan regulations came into force well after appeals were lodged, none of the appeals address the relationship between the regulations and PC1. Accordingly, I said there was no jurisdiction to make Mr. Trevilco's proposed changes to align with them. This is therefore another of the matters that I think we may need to look at section 293 for. But they do seem like quite important changes to ensure that we don't end up with duplication or confusion for that matter. Turning now to the two schedules. There are two different types of farm plans. Schedule D1, there are issues between some parties relating to the structure and purpose of that schedule and its relationship with the freshwater farm plan regulations. Most of the key issues remaining between the parties relate to the standards in Part D. For example, whether and how the standards should apply to matters such as agronomic optimum levels of phosphorus, application rates for nitrogenous fertiliser, and mechanisms for exceeding limits, purchased N surplus, it's nitrogen surplus, grazing of heavy cattle on steeper land during the winter period, standards and implementation timeframes for infrastructure, and nitrogen application rates and effluent block sizing. So there's quite a few points in there really related to matters of detail and I guess workability as well as outcomes that will be achieved. In comparison, there are relatively few key issues remaining between the parties in relation to Schedule D2. Mr. Willis for Fonterra proposes changes to several principles relating to stock exclusion and movement of contaminants to water bodies. He also proposes changes to include requirements for more information. And Mr. Trevilco's outlined his views on those in his rebuttal evidence. I'm dealing with the tables reasonably briefly here. They are detailed tables and they have different states at a range of different locations. But they are linked, table 311.1 in particular is linked to objectives 1 and 2, and it sets out baseline states, target attribute states, both interim 10-year targets and 80-year target attribute states. There is a good level of agreement relating to the content of Table 311.1. However, some parties seek the inclusion of new and amended target attribute states or additional information. These changes are not supported by Dr. Scarsbrook for the reasons he covers in his evidence. And this is relevant to the issue raised earlier about full implementation of the NPSFN. So in other words, there are some of these parts where the Council's position is we should wait until the freshwater policy review to complete that table with the additional attributes. There's no disagreement that more will be needed in that table. The question is, should it be done now through this process or should it wait till next year? Table 311.3 sets out subcatchment application dates, which effectively prioritise subcatchments to comply with Plan Change 1. It might be worth stepping there now, just so you can see how that works. So it's on page 69 of the annexure to our legal submissions. And this is essentially the staging, so that in terms of workability and ability for the sector to apply for the consents and for the council to process them, it was important to break this up into manageable chunks, otherwise there'd be potentially 5,000 applications on day one. And so you'll see here there have been some refinements to those tables, but essentially they go through and they indicate, depending on which catchment or sub-catchment a farm is in, when will it need to apply for a resource consent. So,
I presume there's a small typo at the top of table 3 on page 69. It says table 3.112 on the 3 from cross out.
Yes, that's right, that does look like a typo. I've referred to it, I think, correctly in our submissions as table 311. Three. Oh, and actually it should be 2. It's the new 2. So the typo is in the Imperial version, I think, there, and in my legal submissions for that matter, if we're referring to this latest version. So what's happened is the previous table has been deleted, and the renumbering of the subsequent ones has only been partially completed.
So it should be 2.
It should be 2. If the deletion of table 311 on the previous page is confirmed, which I understand is general agreement between the parties. But thank you, that is a good point, and perhaps if I can remember to do this, I'll endeavour to refer to the new one with its new numbering, but I imagine we might need to be checking that with each other as we go. Thank you, Commissioner Lady. So in that table there, which in my 24.2 should be table 311.2, that sets out the sub-catchment application dates, which effectively prioritise the sub-catchments to comply with the change. Mr. Trebilco has made some changes, and in fact, maybe it's useful to flip over two pages. Page 73 sets out those sub-catchments and the application date. So if you want to see a spatial reflection of that, how that applies across the catchments, you'll see that on the sub-catchments map. So the, I don't know if it's quite from brighter to less bright or from stop to go, but year one's red, year two's in orange, and so on. So that indicates when, who will be applying for consent when. In terms of that, there are some changes to those dates, including prioritisation of certain late catchments, which Dr. Scarsbrook supports. One party seeks that it be clarified that the applicable application date is that for the sub-catchment where the majority of the farmers, and Mr. Trebilco does not support that change. So you'll see there at the top of table 311.2, there's some new red text that relates to this. If a farmer wishes to apply for a consent for more than one property where the properties are defined as a single operating unit, the applicable application date is the earliest year in category. So that's partly connected with that question about how this applies if you're in multiple catchments. It depends on whether a farmer's applying for that together or not, though, in that case. Now, section 25 of our submissions deal with section 293, and this in some respects repeats material that we provided earlier this year in a memorandum of counsel in order to hopefully provide some comfort that section 293 is available, and therefore it's not a wasted exercise to hear the evidence about replacing overseer, for example. I'm not sure whether it's helpful to take you through that now, or whether...
I think you probably should. I think we should hear, everyone should hear what you're saying about that, because I think there's a looming aspect to that, this issue. Okay, put it out on the table and see where we get there.
Thank you, Ron. So as I've noted earlier, there are jurisdictional issues with making amendments to PC1 through the appeal process to provide an alternative framework which does not rely on the use of overseer, or to provide that farm environment plans are firstly to satisfy the requirements of the regulations and then satisfy the additional requirements in PC1. because there is no scope in the appeals for changes to remove overseer as a rule gateway or to make changes to align with the regulations, such changes could only be made as part of the PC1 process if a section 293 of the RMA is utilised. Under section 293, after hearing an appeal against the provisions of any proposed plan, the Environment Court may direct the Council to prepare changes to the proposed plan to address any matters identified by the Court, then to consult the parties and other persons the Court directs about the changes, and then submit the changes to the Court for confirmation. Now here, interpolating, obviously the Council has been proceeding on the basis that it has sought to do a lot of that drafting already, in order to provide as much clarity about what the end product might look like if the Council's proposal is adopted. And that will hopefully enable the Court and the parties to grapple with that in a way that means that the after-hearing appeal component is satisfied well. And then obviously the Council sought that any further amendments be directed to be made by it and consulted on. We've set out the factors that may be considered by the Environment Court in determining whether or not to exercise the discretion under section 293. And as the Court noted in the Invercargill case, it's a broad power, but there has to be a nexus between the matter and the change relief that's being sought. There is a reasonably long list of factors that are listed there, and perhaps tentatively suggest I won't read you out a quote from a case, but I might just let you read that momentarily if it's okay.
Essentially, all of these cases highlight, on the one hand, the desirability of progressing something that is able to be progressed versus the problems that arise if people are not able to participate in something which might suit them.
Yes.
Such as where something comes along which initially they didn't think would affect them, and then it's now proposed to amend that proposal in a way that would affect them.
Yes.
The interesting thing in this case is that we have a wide range of industry representative groups that appear to cover much, if not all, of the ground that PC1 affects, whether overseer is used or not. We have a relatively small number of individual parties, mainly as Section 274 parties in support of one or other of the representative groups, don't we?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. All right.
If I can perhaps take that conversation a little further on.
Certainly.
In terms of the desirability of protecting those who have not been part of this process from something that comes along is out of left field and affects them unduly. What I would say in terms of the two components that we've identified at this point is falling outside scope. The first is, on overseer, it's not just a question about overseer. The overseer is a tool to help identify levels and magnitudes of effects from activities. So that was the tool that was considered the best available at the time the plan change was being developed. What's being proposed is not a new regulation of additional activities, it's the regulation of the same activities using a different tool that has been, maybe through this process, shown to be more appropriate. And so on that particular point, part of the reason why the Council considers that this to be an appropriate use of section 293 is that on that component there is no additional, there's no significant change to what's regulated. It's a question of how it's regulated. Or actually not even so much how it's regulated, it's how it's measured. Then likewise on the freshwater farm plan component, the first point I'd say is this plan change has always had farm environment plans for some components. So again, that is not a new component. The thing that is new is that there are regulations which will apply whether the regional council changes these parts of the provisions or not. And the desirability comes from ensuring that the regulation of those net activities using freshwater farm plans is not done in a way that creates additional burden and multiplication of plans that need to be prepared. And so thinking back to things like appropriateness and the like in terms of Section 2 matters, it seems inherently beneficial to do what's been sought here. It's trying to incorporate things that are coming together in a way that shouldn't disadvantage any party.
And in both cases, the issues have arisen through actions by central government in relation to how these issues have been managed in a national sense. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, well, in terms of overseer, I guess there was a growing recognition of the challenges, and then the government has specifically recognised those challenges itself in relation to the farm plan regulations. Absolutely.
Yes. The real issue may then be not so much whether or not Section 293 is used, but whether or not the full-blown, I mean, on one level, Section 293 gives a broad power to the court to make directions as long as it identifies what it's doing and it consults the parties and such other persons as the court directs. There's a discretion there as to who the court should say ought to be consulted. At the other end, Section 293 begins to look very much like a variation to a plan change, with all that that carries with it. Notification, a submission process, a council hearing, appeals, and then bringing those appeals into line with the appeals on the plan change. That's what we might be faced with, mightn't we?
I think that's a good categorisation of the potential variance.
There would be little chance of a variation at this stage getting anywhere near catching up with the current proceedings before the next plan change is notified.
That's right, Your Honour. That would simply not happen, I would say.
No. Well, so these are the things that we need to consider. And rather than, well, part of submissions that may be made about jurisdiction and the use of Section 293 might, well, rather than going through this checklist, which, as I say, in terms of the general checklist, really is pointing towards the overall justice of using a method which only allows for limited rights of participation in the present circumstances. That may be the more important thing for us to consider in the context of the constraints around trying to make a start on better control of the four principal contaminants in these catchments. So that's really been said for the benefit of everyone who may be listening.
Thank you, Ryan. And perhaps if I do step through the remainder of this, I think it hopefully responds reasonably well to the matters you've outlined. The Council acknowledges that the out-of-scope changes being contemplated, particularly those relating to overseer, are of reasonable complexity, are not agreed between the parties, and could potentially affect a large number of persons, including farmers across the catchment. Although, and this is, I think, an important point, many are already represented by the current parties to the PC1 appeals, which include representative bodies. However, none of those challenges with the use of the process necessarily preclude the use of Section 293 in my submission. Rather, the council considers that the particular circumstances of PC1 should be considered. It's been through a lengthy process of development and appeals. It's been affected by the government's initiatives above in ways that could not have been anticipated when it was being developed and when the appeals were being prepared. These government initiatives have brought into question the efficiency and effectiveness of PC1 provisions relating to overseer and EPPs, and they've raised issues that will need to be addressed through PC1 or a subsequent plan change process. The delay to PC1 has already been considerable, and we recognise that the use of Section 293 could, we consider that it could reduce further delay. The use of Section 293 could assist with achieving an efficient and effective plan change which gives effect to the higher order planning instruments, including Te Ture Whai Mana, within a reasonable time frame. This would enable PC1 to become operative sooner and implement meaningful progress towards restoring and protecting the health and well-being of water bodies and catchments. The Council submits that it would be appropriate in the circumstances for the Court to exercise its discretion to utilise Section 293, provided, of course, that a process is adopted that's fair to those who are not parties to PC1 and avoids further delay in PC1 becoming operative. And so, if following the hearing the Court were to prefer the out-of-scope relief, the following process could be adopted. And this is where we come back to the earlier discussion, I think, of potentially an interim decision or a series of decisions. And the suggestion here is that the Court respectfully would prioritise an interim decision addressing the overseer and freshwater farm plan related aspects of PC1, at the same time giving directions to commence the Section 293 process through the preparation of changes to the proposed plan change to address matters identified by the Court that are out of scope or require further drafting. And as I've said, we'll endeavour to take you as close to that position as we can at this point, but obviously there's potential for a range of further changes to be directed in that interim decision. In light of the fact that there are already a large number of parties involved in the appeals who would have had the opportunity to be heard on the merits of the relevant provisions, the Section 293 process would involve wide public notification of any new and or out-of-scope provisions preferred by the Court, but with a reasonably confined time frame, perhaps in the order of 4 to 6 weeks, for any interested parties to provide written comments to the Council. So, again, to jump in there, the idea being that this process, because this has already been identified, will enable this hearing to be used to test these things in some detail perhaps, and that might provide further comfort that a reasonably concise period could be acceptable for wider consultation on these changes. And then finally, as is the usual approach, those comments would then be provided to the Court to enable the Court to make a final decision, either at the same time as its decision on the balance of PC1 or separately. And if the 293 process is not utilised, in my submission, a mechanism with well understood deficiencies would need to be implemented by the Council, and amendments that substitute overseer with an alternative tool would need to be made through the freshwater policy review. And we're now at the conclusion, which you'll see repeats messages I've already conveyed, and I therefore don't propose to read those out to you again, but just hold that there for reference in terms of requests.
Mr. Conway, could I just sort of interrupt you there? Reading 26.1, that Te Ture Whai Mana is a primary direction setting document. A question that occurred to me earlier when you were discussing objectives and things was why isn't Te Ture Whai Mana an objective? Indeed, the primary objective. Why isn't it that? I know it's implicit in objectives 1 and 2, but why not make it explicit?
It's already there as in the regional policy statement, and so I think that the approach that's been taken here is to say, right, this is already a binding directive in the RPS itself that sits above this plan change, and so then when it comes to this particular plan change, in these provisions, the endeavour that's been made is to put into words the way that will apply in these catchments for these contaminants, rather than repeat it in both the RPS and in the regional plan.
But there'd be no harm in actually doing so, would there? If it's simply a reference at the end of Objective 1, for example, to specifically say, and consistent with, or in order to give effect to the funding.
Well, I guess it's an interesting point. It's certainly not going to make it inconsistent with what it's already endeavouring to do.
My comments really are to just give you a heads up of some areas where I'm looking for some help from your experts. And one of them relates to the four contaminants. Because I think through some of the evidence is that nitrogen is given an undue focus compared to other things, particularly when it's not the key to the number of catchments. And while we can't predict what the 2024 plan change will bring about, will we be able to get an update on the way that plan change is going? And what I'm talking about here is, will there be any changes to the way the four contaminants are dealt with in terms of the use of Overseer or whatever, or some of the risk scorecards? Will there be a requirement to reduce contaminants on a farm-by-farm basis? Is it possible to get an update on where the thinking is on that, simply so that we can not work in isolation of where things may be going? Because I'm very conscious of the fact that some farms will be required to get consents under this plan change, and others may be required to get consents under a plan change in 2 or 3 years' time. And so there could be issues of equity. I'm probably thinking ahead a little bit, but I like to try and understand the risks. If it's possible to just give us an update in general terms as to where people think we're going, I find that very helpful. Would that be possible?
Yes, thank you, Commissioner. And I can perhaps make some overview comments now. Mr. McAuliffe, who's our first witness to come to the witness box today, is overseeing that freshwater policy review, and he may be able to expand or, if necessary, correct what I'm about to say. In essence, the position, as I understand it, is that the freshwater policy review is not intending to radically change the direction of anything that's in Plan Change 1. It's going to use Plan Change 1 as the base and then obviously build out from it. To that end, the latest drafting that's been done for this process is tentatively being used as the draft thinking for what might need to be in that freshwater policy review, but naturally when that comes around there will be a need to update it with whatever comes out of this process. But the goal is to not reinvent the wheel in relation to those four contaminants, but rather to supplement it with what needs to happen for the others.
Thank you, that's helpful, and that was my understanding. I just wondered if it had changed. But I'll have a couple of questions for Mr. McCall on that, so that's something for thinking. I'd just like to come back to the Overseer issue, and there are three things that at an overview level have been influencing my thinking. One is the need to make progress. The other thing is to make sure that the plan is effective and efficient. It'll actually work, and I think that's an important consideration. And I also recall the teleconference we had in June 2022, when all parties agreed there should be no going backwards from the decisions version. And so those are the things that are going through my mind in guiding my thinking. In terms of Overseer, we're talking about the Fonterra risk scorecard, but within the term of PC10, there could well be other scorecards, because there's the vegetable production scorecard that I've seen a draft of. Similarly, there's some talk of one for dry stock farming. There's also the Ruahuwai decision support tool. So do we need to be thinking of other tools than just the Fonterra risk scorecard. This is something that you should be putting to your experts, but I'm giving you the thoughts now. And the other issue that's very clear in my mind is that the current PC1 provides for alternatives to Overseer that provide comparable modelling outputs to Overseer. The first challenge I see is that each output from Overseer changes with a different version. So I'm not quite sure how you'd ever determine what is an equivalent. And so these are technical matters, but they could thwart it if a totally legal position is taken. And so to me, the bottom line is, how do we make this work in a way that no one will be adversely affected? And so I haven't had time to really think through the scorecard issue against the Overseer. But those are the kinds of issues that I will be looking at. And so I think your experts can expect some questions along those lines. In terms of the issue of offsetting, in terms of workability, I share the views of the water quality experts as to how it's going to be possible to say that 100 FMU of E coli per 100 millilitres is equivalent to 2 grams per cubic metre of nitrogen. I just wonder if we're going to be buying problems with a policy like that. So again, please expect some questions along those lines. And on a last point, I haven't got into definitions in any detail, but the final version of the plan change that we have will almost certainly be different to the one we have now. But there are things that come in like small and very low intensity. Are they defined? Is distance of setbacks, or how are distance of setbacks to be determined? There's a whole lot of things like that that I think will need to be worked through if they're not there already. They may be, I just haven't seen them. So those are the kind of things that we will need to look at some stage, not in the big picture, but I think it'd be good if your planning people can be thinking about those things as we go through, because there is a lack of clarity in my mind in seeing these words here. What does that mean? So there's general comments, there's no questions, it's simply saying that these are some of the areas that I will be looking to have clarified on the way through.
Thank you, Commissioner, that's helpful.
Presumably some of these things, like small and very low, are to be understood according to the standards or conditions they're called in the rules, aren't they? They're just descriptive terms.
So for some of them, so yes, they sit in the heading to a rule, and then it's the way the rule works itself that gives you the clarity on what is meant by those things. But that is something that I understand will be helpful to work through.
If Your Honour, the reason I raised that was I read the issue. There's you have your three tiers of low, medium, and high, and that's all very clear. And then I saw small and very low, and I didn't see any way of understanding from that statement what that meant. It may be there, but it wasn't clear to me at that statement.
Well, I don't think it comes from the words. I think you have to read it in terms of the 10 conditions that apply to what is a small and very low intensity plan.
Okay, thank you.
Is that right?
Yes, Your Honour, that's the way I've been applying it. The headings with some of those terms in them are best described by the conditions rather than by the...
Yeah, as long as it's clear, that's fine.
I think the main thing, Commissioner, is that they haven't used the word minor, because they probably know that would set me off. I'd have to refer the matter to another judge who would explode in relation to it.
Okay, thanks, Your Honour.
Enough for policy. Your evidence now, I think, Mr. Conway. Unless there's anything else you want to do before we...
No,
that's
it.
Very good. Thank you.
First witness is Mr. McCall.
Thank you. Again, the good news is that the witness box works. We'll make sure that the microphone is operating.
Good afternoon, Mr. Caller.
Good afternoon.
It's looking all right. Could you please confirm for the court your full name is Bruce Miles McCaller?
That's correct, yes.
Could you just pull the microphone down a little bit? Yes,
that should be.
I hope so.
Yep. Thank you.
And you prepared two statements of evidence for these proceedings, dated 26 May 2023 and 25 August 2023?
Yes, I have.
And the first of those sets out your qualifications and experience?
Yes.
Do you have any corrections to make to those statements?
No, I don't have any corrections.
Thank you. Well, would you then please confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
To the best of my knowledge and belief, yes.
Thank you. Now, Your Honour, if it would assist, we can move straight to questions now. I did ask the witnesses to be ready if it would be useful to read a brief summary, usually based on their executive summary of the evidence, but I didn't want to presume whether that would assist the court or whether you'd rather go straight to it.
That, of course, poses the issue of what the order of the parties may be. And I don't know if there's any strong views. Aren't you for the Director General? I might just ask other parties to think about that and maybe pass notes amongst yourselves about. Ordinarily, I think we would be looking for some degree of continuity in relation to questioning in a multi-party case like this. And so we might be looking at perhaps the, although I'm inviting the Director General to go first, maybe that does mean that I'm looking at the conservation interests, may well go first, followed by the industry interests.
So I think it's hard for notes around, but we did have a brief discussion about this and whether it would be appropriate to go according to the notes.
May make it very easy for me. Thank you.
But I just want to raise that although Fish and Game's listed after the Director General on the list, that's just one of the witnesses which is going to be taken out of order. So,
oh, yes.
I would ask the other parties to consider if I could go after Wairaki Pastoral, which is on page 3 of the list, so rather than straight after the Director General. But I'm sure
I'll consider that. Well, I think that for the moment at least, and subject to any particular problems that may occur or any other particular order issues, I think that Ms. Ongley's suggestion about following the hearing list may make it easier for me, and there's an advantage to all of you in that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honour. Good afternoon, Mr. McCaller. I'm Ms. Tumai, solicitor for the Director General. I've only got one area of questioning I want to go through with you, that's around, of course, the stock exclusions.
Mm-hmm.
So just in terms of your evidence in chief, Mr. McCaller, if you referred to, if I can take you there, it's in the series 301. Have you got a common bundle, or you've got your evidence in front of you?
Yes, I have.
And so in your evidence at paragraph 81, so that's reference 0046 in the evidence bundle. You've referred to the stock exclusion regulations. You've talked about the inconsistency between those stock exclusions and the current Waikato Regional Plan.
Yeah.
Yes. These implementation issues.
That's correct.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also these decisions to be made as to whether the regulation should be rolled out across the region.
Yes, or whether we, from a coffin mark, whether we should be more stringent than the regulations in certain circumstances.
Yes, so that's the point I want to take you to, is in your view, whether you consider particularly in light of the water quality joint witness statement. And if I can take you there, that's at 401 of Bund.
I don't have a copy of the water quality.
And they should be behind you. And at the top of the spine should be the numbers. And is there that dark blue one?
Yes.
So that's 401001 should be the water quality witness statement.
I think that for his purposes it's tab. Oh. Is it?
Sorry.
Oh no, is it tab 1? Yes, tab 1 should have the water quality joint witness statement.
Yes, it does.
Do you have that in front of you now?
Yes, I just need the paragraph number.
Sure. So we start with question 3. That's, well, there's no page number there, but question 3 in the joint witness statement. So in that question, it talks about the relative contributions of the four contaminants from those sources to water bodies. And so when you look at question 3, part 3 of that in the matters of agreement on the next page, you'll see there that the experts at the water quality conferencing agreed there was a dominant source of anthropogenic nitrogen to the Waikato River, Waikato and Waipa.
Yes, I see that.
And also in there it talks about excretion of dung and urine from farm animals is also an issue.
Yes.
And also the primary source of microbial contaminants are fecal material from farm animals.
Mm.
Yes. So in light of those agreements reached at the water quality joint witness conferencing, wouldn't you agree that there are good reason for more stringent provisions in the Clean Change One?
Quite likely, yes, and depending on the catchment, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you, Your Honour. Just had the one area there, thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, I think in terms of the list, the next party might be the Waikato River Authority. Go ahead, can we hear you now? Okay, there's still a problem. You can hear us, and we still seem to have difficulties hearing you. Madam Registrar, have we been able to work on that connection?
Yes,
just unmuted, so she will be.
Okay, go ahead, please.
Can you hear me, sir?
Very clearly now. There we are. There's nothing like the mute button to make a difference.
Thank you. So it's Ryan here for the Waikato River Authority.
Thank
I'm
you.
Here with my friend Ms. Bulow.
Thank you.
Apologies. I think the technical issues this morning were mostly in fault, but we've been listening. We've been able to listen. And just to confirm, I don't. After all that, I don't have any questions.
Well, but the great success of this has been that we have established communication.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. All right. Mr. Pinnell, are you on the line? No?
Yes, I am.
Do you have any questions for Mr. McAuliffe? Or would you rather come later, perhaps, after you've heard what some other parties may want to ask?
I think that would be practical. I have no direct questions.
Very good.
Thank you.
No, thank you very much. All right. Well, then I think we move to Fonterra.
Thank you, Your Honour. No questions for this.
Thank you very much. Land Corp. Now, Lockheel. Is that someone else who was on? Just trying to. Oh,
Ms.
yeah.
Forrett has left.
All right, okay, well, we'll take that as an indication. Federated Farmers.
No questions, thank you.
Very good, thank you. Waikato, Wairaki Pastoral, Mr. Carruthers. Any questions for Mr. McCord?
Yes, I do actually. Thank you, Your Honour, if that's all right.
Of course.
Just a few questions, Mr. McCord. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Right. So, and sorry, I should have asked, is it all right if I remain seated, seeing as I'm appearing?
Yes, of course it is. It would be very odd otherwise.
Excellent. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Mr. McAuliffe, as I understand it from your evidence, the freshwater policy review is intended to align the regional plan with, firstly, the National Policy Statement Freshwater Management, the NES freshwater, and the more recent regulations, both stock exclusion and freshwater farm plans. Is that the scope of the policy review?
Yes, that is correct. And also, the current regional plan outside of this chapter doesn't give full effect to 35 months. So we need to update more of the plan to give effect to that, yes.
Okay, great. And then the freshwater planning instrument that is eventually notified coming out of that review process, that will follow the new process set out in the recent changes to the Act rather than the normal Schedule 1 process.
That's correct. It will follow the freshwater planning process set out in Schedule 1.
Yes. And so in a number of places in your evidence, in the particular paragraphs, that 18, 41, and 86. In each of those places, you say that Plan Change 1 will be either retained or changed in that document. So I wanted to check, when you refer to Plan Change 1 there, are you referring instead to Chapter 311 of the Regional Plan?
Yes, which is what Plan Change 1 is introducing into the Regional Plan.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, just so we're clear on terminology, Plan Change 1 isn't being changed in that later document, but Chapter 311 is being changed in that document.
Yes, I see. Yep. Assume that Plan Change 1 is operative, but...
Sorry, so why do you say assuming it's operative?
Well, if we have a decision from the court, because we do need to notify the Freshwater Policy Review by 31 December 2024.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but your new Freshwater Planning Instrument is going to have an updated Chapter 3.11 in it.
Yes, that is the intention.
And that's regardless of whether Plan Change 1 is operative or not.
That's a question we're trying to, perhaps trying to work through with the legal team, how we navigate that particular tricky issue, if it's not operative.
Sorry, have you not yet turned your mind to that?
Yes, we are turning our mind to it now.
Right. And so is your current working presumption that you need Plan Change 1 operative before you can include Chapter 311 or its equivalent in the new freshwater planning instrument?
Chapter 311 is a change to the regional plan, so we I need to work this through with our legal team. We could potentially change it, but how we do that, I'm not sure at the present time.
Right. So do you know yet if your freshwater planning instrument is going to be a standalone document rather than a change to your regional plan?
It will be two documents. It'll be a change to our regional policy statement. Because some will include changes to our regional policy statement and changes to our regional plan. So I think we're looking at quite major changes to our regional plan.
Yes, and so given the extensive changes to the regional plan, have you turned your mind yet to whether it's a new standalone regional plan or a change to your existing plan? Have you turned your mind to that yet?
Not fully. It's something we're trying to work through at the moment as to what the exact scope and how we go about doing it is. Something we're,
okay.
Because one of the things we're looking at is to the extent that we need to change various chapters of the regional plan to give effect to the MPS at the end.
Okay. So I had understood from your evidence that you were well underway with your preparation of the planning instrument, and I was looking at, there's a helpful diagram you have, and I think it's page 16, your figure 1, where you set out the intended engagement and approach to prepare the next document. And I had understood from your evidence that round 2 in that figure has been completed, and that the provisions of the new instrument were being drafted in 2023, which we're coming to the end of now. So can you give an update at all on where you're at with that work, particularly in light of the answers you've just given on those bigger questions?
Yes, certainly. We have just completed our round 2 engagement. There's still some engagement going on with various parties, and we are in the process of drafting up the policy provisions, so there's some way to go on that. We have a meeting with our councillors next Monday to report on the results of round 2 engagement, and then following that we're taking some draft provisions to them in November. So we're in the middle of drafting at the moment.
Right. And can I just check terminology-wise, when you say policy, are you referring to the objectives and policies, or the entire thing as a policy document?
The entire thing is a policy document.
Okay.
Objectives, policies and rules.
Okay. So, I'd like to move then to two places in your evidence, paragraph 21 and also paragraph 48, where you are looking to ensure an efficient and orderly implementation of the respective rule frameworks in PC1 and this new instrument. Are you able to explain what you're inferring there, given there will be rules, if PC1 is approved, there will be rules in PC1, and I assume other rules in your new instrument. So what are you referring to there when you say an approach which ensures efficient and orderly implementation of those two rule frameworks?
So I think what I'm trying to say there is that through the freshwater policy review that we've got underway at the moment, we're trying to make sure that the implementation of that, what we've got in PC1, and that which is in the freshwater planning instrument, is efficient, can be done efficiently as possible, so that we're not unnecessarily doubling up or being overly restrictive, perhaps in certain areas. That would make sure that we're consistent with PC1.
Right. And so what's an orderly implementation of the two frameworks?
I'd say it's something which is administratively efficient and fair, which we can, and can be implemented by our consents officers.
So are you looking for a situation where once the freshwater planning instrument is notified and presumably its rules have immediate legal effect, that a farmer is only needing consent under one set of those rules at any one time? Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm not sure that's going to be entirely possible. Because the rules in PC1 are operative, we'll still have waiting if they're operative. So, but trying to make that process as efficient as possible, so to minimise too much.
Yes, yeah, so I'm more interested in your use of the orderly implementation. I agree, well, I understand where you're coming from the efficiency perspective, but I wasn't sure what you meant by orderly implementation.
Perhaps orderly is the wrong word in that respect, because it's more about efficiency, in my view.
Right. And so, can I just check then that that shouldn't be taken as an indication that PC1, if it hasn't been made operative by then, will be withdrawn when the new rules are notified?
Yes, I don't think we would withdraw PC1. We can just notify there will be changes to PC1 provisions, but then some of these are issues that we're still trying to work through as we move through the process.
Yeah. So there's also a number of locations in your evidence in the relevant paragraphs of 20, 47 and 94. And each of those, so those numbers again, but 20, 20, 47 and 94. In each of those, you say that the benefit of making Plan Change 1 operative is so that the council can begin implementation of methods. And as I read your evidence, you're referring to the methods in PC1 that sit before the rules. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, are you, so those for the benefit of the court, sorry, I'm just finding the right page. In the version that Mr. Conway has provided to the court with his submissions, it should be page 23. I don't know what the common bundle reference is, if there is one.
I think we are this is
311.
311.3, the implementation methods, yes.
That's right.
Page.
And so, Mr. McAuliffe, the council beginning to implement these methods is what you see as the benefit of Plan Change 1 being made operative.
Yes, I do see the benefit in these council beginning to make these rules operative.
Sorry, rules or these methods?
These methods.
And so are you aware of the methods in 311.3? Which of them the regional council could not do in advance of Plan Change 1? Are there any that the council could not already do?
From my reading. reading at the moment. No, there's not that I can see.
Okay. And then the other benefit that you identify in your evidence relates to point source discharges and the council considering consents for point source discharges. Is that your view of the merits of making Plan Change 1 operative?
Sorry, you're referring to the rules or the
So, paragraph 20, you say that the benefit of PC1 operative is that the council can begin implementation of measures, and those are the methods that I took you through. At 47, you again say the sooner Plan Change 1 is made operative, the sooner the council can begin implementation of measures, and it goes on to refer to those methods that we've just been through in 311.3. And then at 94, I think it is. No, I'm sure you say it somewhere, but I've just momentarily lost it. You also, somewhere in your evidence, I'm pretty confident, you say that a benefit of making Plan Change 1 operative is the point source discharge consenting regime. Do you see that as a benefit of Plan Change 1 being made operative?
Yes, I do. But
and that's the full extent of the benefits as you have identified in your evidence?
I think when I refer to measures, I'm also referring to the rules more widely too.
Right, so where you say council implementation of measures, is that your shorthand for saying introduction of rules?
Yeah, implementation of the whole package, if you like, the measures, the non-registry methods and the rules too. I should have perhaps you've been more concise and used the term provisions.
I see. So you weren't trying to identify just parts of Plan Change 1 that you thought had merit?
No, I was trying to.
Sorry, you might have just broken up then on my audio.
Oh, sorry about that. Yeah. I mean, I do see benefit in the whole Plan Change 1 becoming operative.
Okay. That's useful. Excellent. Thank you, Your Honour. I have no further questions for this witness.
Thank you, Ms. Carruthers. Question again. Thank you, Ms. Ollman.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon, Ms. Martin Paula.
Good afternoon.
Could you have a look, please, at paragraph 18 of your evidence?
Yep.
On 301.0026. And there you say that while the above is the case, regional councils are unlikely to be completely reconceiving the Plan Change 1 provisions afresh through the review, but will rather make some amendments, some of which are substantive, to give effect to the NPSFN. And then you go on to say, I consider that the notified freshwater policy review is unlikely to seek to change the overarching direction or intent of PC1, particularly objectives 1 and 2. The objective 1 in particular refers substantially to the tables at the back of PC1, table 3, 11.1, attribute states, doesn't it?
Yes.
And I just want to take you through the substantive changes that will be required to those changes in order to give effect to ENPSFN. And you've already referred to additional attribute states that may need to be added because they're required by the NPSFM. But I want to focus on the deficiencies with the attribute states that are in there at the moment. The first of all, with lakes, a key interest of Fish and Game, the tables only set long-term attribute states for lakes, i.e. 80 years, at the NPSFM bottom line. Don't they?
Yes.
And for the short term, they set a general narrative of maintain lake water quality.
Yes.
And the councils, and you have acknowledged in your evidence that you will need to look at working on short-term or 10-year attribute states for lakes.
Yes,
and indeed, shallow lakes within the Waikato region are some of the most degraded lakes in New Zealand, aren't they?
I understand, so, yes.
And the experts for lakes on the JWS, and you probably don't need to turn to it, but the reference is 401.040, have said that even maintaining current nutrient loads will result in degradation, and most lakes will require significant reductions to simply maintain current water quality, i.e. within the NOF band. Are you aware of that? That is, we require significant reductions just to maintain lakes.
Yes, I was plain aware of that fact. Yeah.
So the second one I wanted to discuss was the nutrient thresholds, nitrogen and phosphorus in the tributaries. The council is working on nitrogen and phosphorus attribute states to achieve ecosystem health in the subcatchments, or we refer to them as the tributaries, aren't they?
Yeah, I understand we are, yeah.
And currently, nitrogen is set for toxicity purposes, not for ecosystem health in the tributaries, and dissolved reactive phosphorus is set just at current state as a placeholder, isn't it?
Yes, I understand. That's my understanding of science. I mean, I could be correct on that, but yeah.
Thank you. And for the estuaries, the council has recently notified the regional coastal plan, notified as at 8 August 2023.
Yeah.
Yep. And that contains some limits for total phosphorus in the estuarine area.
I don't think so. I don't think if I recall correctly. We didn't put water quality limits within the regional coastal plan as notified.
All right, it may be a limit for a point source discharge application.
Yeah.
I have schedule 9B trigger value limits, and there's limits for dissolved reactive phosphorus and total phosphorus. But in any case, in any event, you'll need to relook at the both the total nitrogen and the total phosphorus values in the Waikato main stem and evaluate whether they would achieve requirements for downstream estuarine health?
That is something that we're looking at through the process and working through with Mr. Scarsbrook's team. Yeah.
Okay.
How we go about doing that, or what we need to do in that respect. So a lot of the science is being worked through as we speak for the freshwater policy review.
And so you may need to change the total nitrogen and total phosphorus attributes in the main stem of the Waikato River, which I think is what you've said.
Well, we may do. I need to need the advice of the scientists on that.
Thank you. So, if we go back to your paragraph 18, you're saying that you consider that the notified freshwater policy review is unlikely to seek to change the overarching direction. Isn't it correct that because there may need to be substantial changes to the tables in 3.11.1, that there may need to be effectively extensive change to those objectives?
Possibly. That's something my team is working through at the moment. We see that the overall objective of Plan Change 1 is sound based on the process that it's been through. The 80-year time frame has been set for that catchment, and so we're just working through those matters. We are in the process of developing long-term visions, etc., and objectives for the catchment.
Yes, and just in relation to that, I think you've said it in your evidence that the NPSFM requires you to determine the visions,
yeah.
To look at the values, and there are values that you can consider that are compulsory in Appendix 1A, and then there are other values in Appendix 1B to the NPSFM.
Yes.
And then you need to set attribute states for those values, mm-hmm. and those are in Appendices 2A and 2B.
Yes.
And for the attribute states in 2A, you need to identify limits on resource use and any nutrient outcomes to achieve those states and include those as goals.
Yes.
And in your evidence, paragraph 78C on page 301.0014, you've said at the end of there that it would also be appropriate to review the PC1 priorities with respect to the NPSFM 2020 hierarchy of obligations that puts the health and wellbeing of water bodies first. So those are relatively fundamental considerations, aren't they?
Yes, they are, and that's precisely why we're looking at them, just to see how well PC1 measured up against the NPSFM requirements.
Thank you. So a couple of issues arise from that. Oh, just one more change that you might need to look at. I think you've said that you don't intend to change the 80-year, the longevity of the long-term attribute states. You don't intend to change that from 80 years.
Well, we're not intending to change the overall direction of PC1.
Yes. But the NPSFM may require you to set medium-term attribute states because it requires in 3.11.6, I think it is, 10-year steps. On page
501.0089. Yeah, I've got a copy of the NPSFM with me.
Thank you. And that, I'll just repeat, that's 3.11.6A, which says that must include interim target attribute states set for intervals of not more than 10 years to be used to assess progress towards achieving the target attribute states in the long term. Do you read that as meaning that there might need to be a medium term attribute state?
Yes, I do. And that's something that we're looking at, looking into, I understand, as part of our review.
Okay, so just returning to the couple of issues that arise from this. The first is policy 7 of PC1 and the council's position that consents under PC1 with off-use discharges could be granted for a term of up to 15 years. There is a real issue here, isn't there, about the tail, if you like, of PC1. And if you grant consents for 15 years, we're looking at 2035 before those consents can be reviewed. Or not reviewed. You're giving an expectation to farmers until 2035, are you not, with 15-year terms?
Yeah, it says not granting consent duration of not more than 15 years. So that would be an indication of how long we're going to grant the consents for.
Well, what I'm putting to you is that given the quite fundamental changes that need to be made, particularly for nitrogen and phosphorus, and particularly for lake catchments, as well as for other issues that have been identified by the freshwater scientists, that 15 years is too long.
I think that's something which my team needs to look at in some detail, whether it is too long, and it's something that is being reviewed at the moment. They are working their way through these issues, very issues at the moment, so it's something that I'll take to council when I've got a recommendation to do so.
All right, thank you. But their evidence at the moment, you're aware, aren't there, is to support the 15-year term,
yeah,
and to support at the beginning.
Support the overall direction, yes. Yeah.
So your counsel, in reading up his legal submission, raised the NBEA transitional provisions, which require some estimation of not granting a consent 5 years after new allocation rules have effect. And if I understood him correctly, he said that you don't know when new allocation rules might have effect, so that might either be too short, the 15 years might either be too short or too long, but in any event, this provision, if it remains in place, will override this 15-year term. Did you follow that line of thinking?
Yeah, it is something which I know our consents people are working through at the moment, not just in relation to this, but in relation to other issues also, as to the timing when it becomes operative and how long consents get granted for and when the NBA plans get prepared for. And I understand that depends on which tranche of NBA plan that Waikato is in.
Right. Okay. So you don't really have any idea at the moment?
Not a clear idea that I can assist the court with, no.
Regional Council had a document in 2017 called the Waikato Freshwater Strategy, and it's in the bundle at 501.1606. and it was a strategy to deliver the best use of fresh water through time. I'll let you get that. If you could turn please to firstly 501.1612, which is the introductory discussion, and in the second column of that page it groups the issues of the strategy, and it says number one, focused advocacy for legislative reform and ongoing decision making. Number two, smarter methods with an analysis of options, including allocation methods and economic instruments. And then three, better information, including supply and demand balance, allocation pressures, water usage, and freshwater climate science. Rather than go through the whole strategy, I'll then take you to page 501.1621, which is 1.4 strategy directions. And you can see in paragraph 3 there, around the middle of that paragraph, it says grandparenting of freshwater allocations does not assist in transformation but tends to cement the status quo by doing the same thing with only minor improvements. And this strategy will provide choices for landowners for the use of their land in the future, and through the use of financial incentives, should not lock them into existing uses, the effects of which are increasingly becoming intolerable to the predominantly urban, well, it says urban population, but I'm sure there are a few other parts of the population that are concerned with water quality. Are you familiar with the strategy document?
Broadly, it's a number of years since I looked at it, but.
And are you aware that in the strategy document it discusses advocating and collaborating with central government on allocation tools and methods, including economic methods to put a price on a similar to the capacity of water?
Yeah, I had talked to the author of the strategy about that, those sorts of things.
And the NBEA has principles for resource allocation as distinct from first-in, first-served allocations on it, and other tools such as comparative consenting processes. Have you looked at those?
I'm aware of those principles that are in the NBA, yes. But I haven't taken any further than that.
And the NBEA also contains a provisions around a freshwater working group where the purposes are section 97 and subpart 7. The purpose of the working group is to produce a report that makes recommendations on matters relating to freshwater allocation and on a process for engagement between the Crown, iwi and hapu at the regional or local level on freshwater allocation. And you're aware of that?
In the background, I've been aware of it, but it's not something that I've sort of looked at in any detail, because we're focused on giving effect under the RMA at the present time through the plan change in our regional plan review.
But we have real tensions with this plan change, don't we, in both Tangata Whenua and commercial vegetable growers seeking additional allocation of a similar sort of capacity of fresh water when there's no, and I'll call it headroom, available. So isn't the fact that these tools are raised by government, flagged clearly in the NBEA, also relevant to the consent terms you give farmers at the moment?
Possibly, but I understand it's being worked through at the moment. I'm sorry, I'm giving quite a vague answer, but it is, I know our consent planners are working through those sorts of questions at the moment, and those sort of something that we need to perhaps look at, give consideration to in the fresh water policy review, how we proceed up along those lines.
All right, well, I'll pursue that with Mr. Trebilco, who is the relevant planner giving evidence here. But if I can move to another topic. The paragraph 60 of your evidence says that the regional council staff are not proposing changes to FMUs. And Fish and Game has sought an FMU for the Whangamarino wetland and FMUs for lakes catchments that aren't based on the geomorphological categories, which are riverine, peat, dune and volcanic. Fish and Game considers those are too coarse. Shall I address those questions about the merits of reconsidering the FMUs to you or to your...
To Mr. Trebilco, because...
Yes.
So we've got to take a break at some stage. How much more do you have?
About 5 minutes.
There may be others after you, so we'll take a break now. Thank you. Return the call to Mr. McCaller. I'm not sure if you've been under cross-examination before.
No.
The rule is that you should not talk with anyone about the content of your evidence or about this case while you're subject to cross-examination. The best guidance I can give you is just to think about things yourself and not engage in any discussion with anyone.
Okay, certainly not.